Before we get started with today's episode of Amped Up with Ryan Knight, we want to let you know that we have exclusive bonus content on Patreon at patreon.com/ampedup. You can find the video versions of all our interviews, as well as bonus content with me, Ryan's producer, Rob Bermudez. So make sure you check out our bonus content today at patreon.com/ampedup. Thanks for your support and enjoy the show.
Welcome to Amped Up. This is your host, Ryan Knight, and our guest today is Councilmember Shama Sawant. Shama is an independent socialist and Seattle City Council member. Shama, welcome to Amped Up.
Thank you so much for having me.
So I want to start off by asking you about this right-wing recall campaign. For my listeners who don't know, big business and the right are trying to overturn democracy in Seattle and remove you from office. This comes just a few months after your council office and a grassroots socialist movement won the Amazon tax, which is a tax on the top 500 companies in Seattle that will raise an estimated $240 million a year to create tens of thousands of green union jobs by building permanently affordable social housing. Is that what this whole recall campaign is about? You know, is it the fact that big business just can't handle any victories for working people? So they're trying to remove one of their most effective advocates. And how can we help you fight back against this?
There's no question that the recall, has any legitimacy to it. If you look at the four charges that the recall petition has, they are all based in falsehood. They charge that I broke the law, but to be very, very clear, crystal clear, we did not break the law. I did not break the law in any way. And as you were alluding to, Ryan, this really is an attack on our Socialist Council office, on Socialist Alternative, my organization, but primarily it's not just an attack on me and my organization, it's an attack on the entire socialist left and progressive movements in general. And it's no coincidence that two of the four charges, the two of the, you know, four false charges are related to the Black Lives Matter movement. They are going against. Those charges are attacking me for the role I played in support of the Black Lives Matter movement. So really, it's part of the nationwide targeting of Black Lives Matter activists. As you know, it's also no coincidence that over 14,000 BLM activists have been arrested throughout the course of last year. And the reason is, of course, that the ruling class, the capitalist class, the wealthy, they are terrified at something like what happened last summer, where you had 26 million ordinary people, Americans, come out in the streets in multiracial solidarity against racism, against police violence. But also the more intelligent ones in the ruling class, they understand that the BLM protest and the fire it ignited had not only to do with racism and police violence, but it captured the overall frustration, especially in the younger generations, because they understand that the society has very little to offer. There is anger against corporate politics, and there is an idea that there is something needs to be done to immediately change the status quo. There is anger against climate change. All of that was captured, and it was a warning shot to the ruling class as to what to come. That is why they are now attacking the left. And the recall campaign against our office is part of that whole maneuver. And specifically, they are angry at the victories we have won in Seattle. You mentioned the historic Amazon tax that we won. And they want a do-over of the re-election victory that they could not prevent in 2019.
Hmm. And not only the Amazon tax, you also won a $15 minimum wage all the way back in 2014. And I think what's important about that is here we are 6 years later, and progressives in Congress still can't even get the capitalist Democratic Party, which controls our entire government right now, to pass a $15 minimum wage. Can you share with us a little bit on the approach that you used to win the fight for $15 in Seattle and how it differs from the approach that progressives in Congress are using right now that is clearly not working?
Absolutely. I think it's really positive that so many, new progressive left people are getting elected throughout the nation, because it shows you not so much about whether what they are willing to do to fight for working class people, but what it shows is that the working class is looking for a change away from the business as usual corporate politics. And it's also important that many progressive council members and also Senator Bernie Sanders have been speaking out positively about $15 an hour. But I think, as you're suggesting, Ryan, it doesn't go far enough. And just, you know, a few months back when there was a whole debate around force the vote for Medicare for All, I know AOC at that time had, you know, she had tweeted that she had said, if you want a model on how we can successfully secure floor votes on progressive legislation, examine how we can win, you know, how we won the $15 minimum wage vote in the House and so on and so forth. And I think that that statement misses the real story of $15 an hour. It completely misses how we were able to win $15 an hour. The reason we were able to make Seattle the first major city to win $15 an hour as the minimum wage, and which led to victories in dozens of other cities, that was because of a socialist strategy, a fighting strategy used by my council office, by Socialist Alternative, by progressive labor unions, who all got together and launched the 15 Now movement. And the reason I describe it that way is that, you know, just to give some background, my first term in office started in January 2014 with a couple of corporate Democratic Council members privately warning me that even though I had rabble-roused my way into City Hall, that I was not going to win any minimum wage increase, much less $15 an hour. And they very kindly informed me that City Hall ran on their terms. And by June of that year, we had won the unanimous and historic City Council vote, including those two City Council members who were forced to vote yes on it. But here's the deal. Far from being the result of vote counting or negotiations by my office, in addition to some little outside pressure like the Progressive Democrats are doing right now, that victory saw the light of day only because we were very clear that we had to use a fighting approach from the very beginning. And that fighting approach overcame not only the corporate opposition, but very importantly, it also overcame the cautious instincts of some of the well-meaning Democrats and some labor leaders who are reluctant to openly clash with the political establishment of their own party, you know, of the Democratic Party, and much less so with big business entities. And I think that's where the crux of this whole discussion on the left lies right now, on the question of how can we win federal $15 an hour, how we were able to win in Seattle. And let me just say, you know, at the outset, let's just dispense with whatever false dichotomies that people have out there. You know, we see this from political pundits all the time that, oh, well, you know, you can do progressive things at the city level. Let's focus on local politics. No, I mean, look, if anybody believes that we can fight for working people and win victories and go under the radar of big business and the Democratic establishment and not invite their wrath just because we are local, well, let's dispense with that falsehood because we have a recall campaign against us. So there is no such thing. So, and I think this is where the crux of the debate lies, is whether well-meaning or not, what people on the left are looking to do, and this is, we see this in the leaders in the squad as well, is a reluctance to have an open clash with big business and the politicians who represent the ideas of big business. And I think
that's right.
Unless you have the willingness to embrace that clash, and furthermore, fundamentally understand that under capitalism, it is posed as a clash. You didn't create, you know, as others have said, you didn't make it a class struggle. It is a class struggle because the capitalist class and their politicians, they fight to the bitter end for their interests, and we have to do the same. And can I just say, I mean, right now, the what are we observing in the Senate and the House and in D.C.? We're seeing somebody like Joe Manchin, who is a corporate politician, he's a corporate Democrat. Joe Manchin is going to the mat for the class he represents, which is
That's
big
right.
business and the wealthy. So the question is, why won't Bernie Sanders and the squad go to the mat to represent working class interests? That is what we need. And so what do I mean by that? And just to take it back to how we won 15 in Seattle, the way we won 15 was to refuse to have negotiations by well-meaning leaders and with big business. We were part of that as well. But our real power, our real edge to actually win a victory, because that's what matters at the end. We're not posturing here. We're not here for navel gazing. We want to win victories for the working class, really make material shifts in people's lives. And so the way we won it was building the 15 Now movement, which launched mass action conferences, carried out rallies, marches. It was the kind of going to the mat that big business politicians do for their own interests. That's right. What we need to do. And so
I absolutely agree with you. And when I heard you on Brianna's podcast, I couldn't, you know, I was one of the people who helped plan the Force the Vote campaign. And just to see the tepid response from progressives in Congress, it made me realize that they just have a fundamental misunderstanding of where they get their power from. AOC and Bernie Sanders don't get their power from the corrupt establishment. They get their power from the grassroots, from the people, from the working class. And so it's you know, Nancy Pelosi and Joe Biden and the DNC are not on the side of working people. They're on the side of big business and giant corporations. And so if you want to win victories, you have to summon the pressure of the grassroots, and you have to fight and show them that you'll fight for them and rally people behind and create that moment that kind of exposes the rot in the Democratic Party, which AOC and the squad, they do a great job of exposing the rot in the Republican Party. But I feel like we're now at a moment in history where, like, that's not enough anymore. Everyone gets it. The Republican Party is corrupt to the core. But just like the Republican Party, the Democratic Party is also corrupt to the core, and that it serves the interest of the 1% of big business and continues to rig the system against the working class. So stand up, fight back. Use the kind of grassroots movement that you've talked about and push back against the corrupt establishment.
I think you hit the nail on the head, Ryan. It's about where you go for, if you're a genuinely representing working class people, which I believe they're genuine, you know, Bernie Sanders and the squad, they genuinely want to represent ordinary people who don't have a voice. But it's a question of, where do you go for your power? You know, so the corporate politicians like Joe Manchin and Kristen Sinema, and by the way, did you see so jubilantly she voted no against $15 an hour? I mean, it's absolutely just disgusting.
It made me disgusted.
Yeah, exactly. It's just stomach turning. You know, but the point is that she's so jubilant. Kristen Sinema is so jubilantly voting against 15 because she's unashamedly, unabashedly representing corporate interests, the interests of the capitalist class. And so it really comes down to, as you said correctly, the question of power. Where do you go? Corporate politicians have the entire system and Wall Street and billionaires on their side. When you're a working class representative, where are you going to go? Your strength is not going to come from trying to find common ground, trying to make peace with the Democratic establishment. That is not where your power lies. Your power lies in turning outward. So, you know, I want to come back in a second as to what I think they should do right now. But even before this, had Bernie Sanders called for mass rallies of hundreds of thousands of people in Georgia, in West Virginia, in Arizona? Go to the working people in Joe Manchin's district. Go to the working people in Kristen Sinema's district. Go to all the black working class people in Georgia whom Biden said, just vote for us, we'll take care of you. But right now they're selling them out. You know, go to the people who voted for the Democratic Party in the hope that something will change, and fire them up. Tell them to come out in rallies. And they will. As you said, millions of people are ready to back them up if they are to show courage. Obviously, that moment has passed. But right now, I think, you know, now that the Senate bill without the $15 an hour is going back to the House, the question is, what will the squad do? And here is, you know, this is my appeal to the squad. You know, declare that you will use your numerical balance of power in the House to force $15 an hour inside the stimulus bill. I mean, $15 an hour is a crucial issue. Make it clear, you're not going to vote for the stimulus bill unless it includes 15. And I will also say that for any corporate politicians if any corporate politician accuses the squad of holding up the unemployment benefits, I think we should be bold and say that's absolutely gaslighting. The only people who would be holding up anything are the corporate politicians who are against $15 an hour. So have the courage to do that and urge millions of people to come out and fight for you and have your back, and that will happen. I personally am happy to fly to DC if this is if they're willing to hold this up and fight for us, we will have their back.
Yep. No, that's absolutely right. And that's those moments also, they you know, you can't heal what you don't reveal. And so a lot of Americans don't realize how corrupt the Democratic Party is. And so if AOC and Bernie and the squad, they start fighting back against them and say, no, we are going to fight for a living wage. $15 was already the compromise position. And the Democrats have such a small majority in the House that you're absolutely right. Just six of them can stop any legislation if they band together and say, we won't support this unless you include concessions for the people. And you know, I think just bigger picture, you know, because it's not just the $15 that Biden and the Democrats are folding on. You know, what is your reaction to the fact that in a pandemic and in a moment of deep inequality and injustice, Joe Biden and the Democratic Party are not only not fighting for the fundamental change that we need, but they are they're actually walking back their moderate campaign promises, like the $15 minimum wage. They've walked back even the public option. They gave more subsidies to giant insurance companies in the COVID relief. And the $2,000 immediate relief checks, which Joe Biden promised, they're now $1,400 checks that are going to 17 million fewer Americans than Trump's checks did. That means that Joe Biden is giving less relief to less people than Donald Trump did. I mean, this is outrageous. What is your reaction to all of that?
It is. And actually, and to your point, Ryan, the fact is that Joe Manchin did not even have to himself remove 15 from the Senate stimulus bill. Schumer and Biden did that. I mean, that's the role they're playing, where they are kowtowing to the vilest pro-corporate politicians in their party. And, you know, the thing is, obviously, it's you know, I wouldn't underestimate the kind of pressure you feel once you're elected. It is a huge pressure, that it's an onslaught that comes on you. And that's why I just wanted to emphasize the earlier point that you and I were talking about, which is that you have to have something on your side. You have to empower yourself. And you cannot be empowering yourself if you don't build mass movements. And that is the fundamental difference between the approach we have used in Seattle and the approach that Bernie Sanders and the Congress have, and the squad in Congress have done, which is the absence of those mass movements that they're willing to call for.
And what's frustrating, but Bernie and AOC and the squad have a mass movement, they just don't use it. They're not using it as a tool, right? Bernie built a campaign he has millions and millions of followers. I was one of his supporters, but they're not using the grassroots to their advantage to put pressure on the corrupt Democratic Party.
Absolutely, and you cannot bring out millions of people only in election years. You know, all the people that fought to win elected offices for as a voice for ourselves, we need to keep organizing. We need, you know, so there's an obligation. There's a special obligation on people in leadership positions that you really go all out. And it's not enough to say you support 15 or put in an amendment that then fails. That is good, but that's not enough. It's important to rally people into fighting around you. And it's important to call out the things that, call out a spade as a spade. I mean, just to use the question of the whole parliamentarian thing. I mean, right now, it is important for the squad. It's important for Bernie Sanders and others and other progressives to point out very sharply, not in a mild way, but sharply, that the corporate Democrats are hiding behind the process. When they say parliamentarian, I mean, first of all, I'd never even heard of any parliamentarian until a few days ago. I'd never, you know.
Same. Like, who is this magical parliamentarian who just comes along? And then someone, one of the pundits on CNN, they said it was so ridiculous, but it's like they're acting like this parliamentarian has more power than the president of the United States and the vice president, which it turns out they don't. The vice president has the ability and the power to overrule the parliamentarian, but we need to be really clear. Kamala Harris chose not to do that.
Absolutely.
She chose not to overrule the parliamentarian to give the working class a $15 minimum wage.
Exactly.
And we need to call her out for that.
Yes, exactly. And that's the thing. But though, you know, we are calling her out, but we need the Democrat, the progressive Democrats, the left inside the Democrat to call her out in the way we are calling her. That's what I mean. I mean, there's a difference between how we call out Democrats in Seattle and what they are willing to do in Congress. I think that's where the difference lies. It is important, for example, for the squad to point out, this is all smoke and mirrors. You are trying to trick working people into believing that there's an actual rule that you have to follow. And all this talk about how many votes does it need in the Senate to override the parliamentarian? Are you kidding me? That's a trick question to fool working people. The answer is none. No votes are needed. Kamala Harris can override that at any moment she chose. But she is choosing to be on the side of big business.
That's right. And just to kind of, I mean, to add another layer to the conversation, during his campaign last year, Joe Biden claimed that he would be, and I quote, the most progressive president in history. We all knew that that was a lie. I mean, in his first month of his presidency already proves that that was a lie by walking back, like I said earlier, all of his moderate campaign promises, like the $15 living wage and, you know, the $2,000 checks and a public option. But millions of struggling working people fell for his lie and continue to fall for the lies of the Democratic Party that markets itself as the party of working people when it's campaigning, and then turns around and stabs working people in the back when it gets power. How can we as socialists break through this illusion that the Democratic Party serves the people and expose to a broader audience that, just like the Republican Party, the Democratic Party serves the interests of the 1% and the capitalist class and is really standing in the way of progress?
I think that the working class, you know, in some shape or form is starting to understand that that is not working. And I think that is why what we are going to see is nothing like the Obama era. I mean, to give you an example, you know, Biden is not going to have the so-called honeymoon, anything like Obama. I mean, Obama's honeymoon lasted for years during, you know, he came into power during the Great Recession. The burden of the recession was put on the shoulders of ordinary people, but it took people a little bit of time to understand that that's what's going on. I don't think that that kind of honeymoon is going to be attainable for Biden. But at the same time, I would also point out that the fact that the big business politicians and the entire Congress and the White House and, you know, all of DC, the fact that they are having to pass the biggest stimulus check, in such a long time, that itself shows the pressure that they are under. And they are, and also the statements you heard from Biden not actually calling for a vote for the union in Alabama, but saying things that are supportive. I mean, we have to recognize that all of those are signs that there is tremendous pressure on the Democratic Party, one, because they know that times are changing and people are understanding, but also because of the scale of the crisis. I mean, just the collapse that people's lives have experienced, 500,000 people dead from COVID, and the economic misery that people are feeling. And also the ruling class is afraid of a resurgence of a BLM movement like last year, or, you know, movements on that scale with that kind of unity. So I think at this moment, it is crucial for us on the left to very clearly point out, just like we're doing right now, what the Democratic Party is not willing to do. But at the same time, also importantly, point out why being a part of the Democratic Party is a losing strategy for the working class. I think that itself has to be pointed out. Not everybody is going to agree with us at this moment, but it's important for us to raise sights of people, because there will be a lot of people who will be listening to us, they will be processing what we're saying. And sometime in the future, they're going to understand that we were right about this. And so we have to have a sort of a dual process where, on the one hand, we don't mince words. We say the truth like it is, and we don't hide the truth from the working class. We have an obligation to always be truthful to the working class. But at the same time, understand that even people who don't agree with us right now are listening to us. We have an audience. The left has never had such an audience in our lifetimes, in generations. And so the worst thing we can do is to squander that moment. And that is why I'm actually happy that even some of the people who did not agree with force the vote are now actually speaking up and saying, you need to fight for $15 an hour. I think those things are very important. And at the same time, we need to continue fighting around like the union struggles in against Amazon as well.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I mean, if you just look bigger picture, right now in the United States, 78% of Americans live paycheck to paycheck. 140 million Americans are poor or low income. 92 million Americans are underinsured or uninsured. We have 40 million Americans who face the threat of looming evictions. And you contrast this with the fact that just three billionaires now hold more wealth than half of our entire nation. And it is clear that our decrepit capitalist system is not working for the majority of the people. And while socialism is now more popular than capitalism with Americans under 40, which I think is just enormously important and shows that the future of this country is socialism, but yet there's still such a fear in much of the country about socialism. Why, Shama, do you think Americans are so afraid of socialism when it is capitalism that is clearly killing us and failing us? And how do we break this fear and get more people to embrace a socialist movement and a socialist worldview?
I think you were absolutely right, Ryan, that we are now in a different era. This is not the Cold War era. So actually, for the younger generation, for young people, I think the bad word is not socialism, it's capitalism. And
that's
while
right.
not, you know, the people may not know much about socialism yet, they are very curious about it. And one thing that they do know is that the status quo is not working for them. And I think it's important to clarify what we mean by socialism. And I would say, what are we fighting for? And what we need, in fact, at this point, it's not a question of, this would be nice. At this point, it's a question of this would be necessary. Our planet's survival is at stake at this moment. And the whole fiasco in Texas shows so graphically that capitalism is not able to do even basic things like make sure everybody has power in their homes when there is a sub-zero episode in Texas where, you know, things don't get cold that often. Well, why should it be a challenge? This is the 21st century. This is the richest country in the world. How is it possible that not only did 4 million people suffer for multiple days without power in sub-zero temperatures, people died because of the way the system works, because it prioritizes profit maximizing for a few energy millionaires and billionaires who refuse to meet the demand, you know, the surge demand for electricity. So, you know, I think that's a very good example of how a basic thing such as heating for your home when it's cold, capitalism cannot deliver that. And that, of course, magnified globally, it shows that the climate catastrophe is at our doorstep unless we fight back immediately. So what are we fighting for? And what does it mean to have a socialist society? In my view, I would describe it as having a global society, having a world where the incredible wealth, natural resources, technological capability, and creativity of the human society is able to be harnessed to deliver high standards of living for all human beings in an environmentally sustainable way. I think if you explain that as the vision, it really appeals to a lot of people that, yes, that is worth fighting for. And as you were saying, Ryan, young people are certainly, you know, there is a real hunger to fight
yep.
back. What's missing is the leadership on how to actually go about it. And I think all of that, you know, the fighting for that vision is also tied to building a successful mass movement, for example, for Medicare for All, for a Green New Deal jobs program, all of it funded by taxing big business. In Texas, it's a question of taking the energy corporations into democratic public ownership. And I think providing leadership, providing the strategy and tactics for achieving those concrete demands, I think that is what's missing, really.
Yeah, and one of the things that I've been reading a lot of theory recently, and it just dawned on me, you know, my radicalization has been very fast, and I get that most people don't have maybe that kind of big awakening that I had. I mean, I describe mine as like literally, you know, those movies where you think the movie's about one thing, and then you find out at the end, like, oh, the character was dead the whole time. I mean, I had just like a really quick radicalization where it was like, I was a Democrat for, you know, 18 years, and, you know, I fell for all the platitudes, hook, line, and sinker. until I finally just kind of woke up and, you know, last year and was like, oh my gosh, like, no, like the Democratic Party does not work for the people. You know, they work for their corporate donors. You know, the reason they say things like healthcare is a human right while they're fighting against Medicare for all. Or they say climate change is real, but they're fighting against a Green New Deal because they're beholden to the big oil companies, right? Just like the Republicans. Or they say Black Lives Matter, but they don't support defunding the police or reparations or any kind of material policy that would improve the lives of Black and brown people. So it just kind of dawned on me that, like, oh my gosh, this party, it's like all smoke and mirrors. It's all, you know, they make all these promises. They kind of, you know what they do? They co-opt the language of the socialist movement and the progressive movement because they want our votes, but they don't actually support any of the policies that would improve people's lives, right? And so when that dawned on me, and then you start to read theory, and I'm like, very simply, like, capitalism is antithetical to democracy because it has concentrated the majority of the economic and political power in our society in the hands of a very small amount of people by exploiting the labor of the many. And when you have a society like that, that exploits the wealth in such few hands, it creates all this imbalance and injustice. And then, like you said, you factor in the climate crisis and it just shows you that this system is not sustainable. And then you factor in imperialism and you realize what our nation is actually doing to other nations, that it's not just exploiting the working class here at home to maximize profits for the ruling class. We're actually bombing and overthrowing other governments and forcing a kind of neoliberal capitalist system onto them and hoarding and exploiting their resources and to enrich our oligarchy. You know, so when people say things like America is a beacon of democracy for the world, no, like, our export isn't democracy. We're exporting oligarchy. We're exporting war and death and oligarchy onto the world and forcing kind of this cruel empire onto the world. And so when you start to read theory and, you know, just the people I've met in the last year, it opens your eyes that, like, capitalism isn't democracy. What's democracy is the working class owning the means of production. You know, they get to own their work. They get to own a piece of the fruits of their labor instead of being exploited. And it just makes perfect sense that, like, everything is backwards. You know, everything we're taught when we grow up, we're, like, indoctrinated into this system. People think, well, I'm either a red capitalist or a blue capitalist. And it's like, maybe there's a better way.
No, and also, as you were saying, there is no such thing as everybody becoming as rich as a capitalist, because the reason they are rich is by impoverishing billions of people. So it is a zero-sum game. Remember that Econ 101 class that you might have taken where you were told that it's not a zero-sum game? Oh, it is so a zero-sum game. I mean, that was a big lie. And I'm especially passionate about this because I'm an economics professor myself. And in one of my classes, actually, the head of the department actually tried to get me fired because I was not teaching economics in the way that, you know, the lies are taught, as you said. So I think your story, I'm so glad you shared that story, because, Ryan, I think that will resonate with a lot of people, even if they haven't had this kind of awakening that you've had. I think it will speak to them, because people are questioning that this is simply not working. No matter which aspect of society you see, it is not working, whether it is dealing with a pandemic, whether it's climate change, whether it is the question of providing decent education for everybody. And also, not to mention, even at this moment in the richest country in the history of humanity, there are people who are malnourished or hungry. How can this be possible, right? So that doesn't work. And I think the point about democratic public ownership is very crucial, because we're not talking about socialism in the abstract. We actually want a change in society, but that cannot happen unless workers have a say. You know, working people, millions, the billions, have a say in how society's resources are used. And the simple and bitter truth about capitalism is that you cannot control what you don't own. So there is no hope of actually making a shift towards clean, renewable energy and ending fossil fuel use as long as a few billionaires own the fossil fuel industry. It's as simple as that. It is magical thinking for anybody, you know, for example, in the Democratic Party, to tell us that we could actually make a shift even while the billionaires own that wealth. No, it's not possible. A necessary step for addressing climate change will be taking the energy, infrastructure, and fossil fuel companies into democratic public ownership of workers so that workers together can decide and will decide, because that will be good for the society, will decide to move towards clean renewable energy and the use of fossil fuels. And I think that's the kind of say we need in our economy and society as a whole. And that is really what it will come down to in terms of act. What does it look like to concretely move towards socialism? That's what it looks like.
Well, absolutely. And right now, it's so funny you mentioned the economics, because the economics we're taught is that basically that profits are more important than people. And more important than our natural resources, and more important than our planet.
And then the way they try to convince you is by saying, but by the way, that's good for you. That's good for the planet.
It's good for the few people who are the capitalists at the top, who exploit people to maximize their profits. But yeah, no, we're starting to see the effects. And I think the real battle, you know, when you start to read history, the fights we're having are the same fights that the socialists fought, you know, in the 30s when they were pressuring FDR for the New Deal. And, you know, people like Wallace were saying things like, both parties serve the interests of big business. The Republican Party admits it. It's the Democratic Party that attempts to conceal it. So the Democratic Party has always been on the side of big business. They just kind of have hidden that from the people to try to soften capitalism. It's almost like they're the PR department for our decrepit capitalist system, where they try to make it sound not as harsh as it really is. Well, the cold hard facts show that more and more people are being pushed out by this economy. The billionaires are getting richer. The poor are getting poorer. And I think we're at a moment now where it's like, enough is enough. You know, people are more important than the profits of a few. And also, like, what is our purpose here? I think it's people are starting to ask bigger questions, because if humanity's whole purpose is just to maximize the profits of a few shareholders at any cost, which is destroying our earth and our habitat, at some point the planet will no longer be habitable. And I guarantee you that those people, that our grandkids, 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 aren't going to care about the prosperity that their you know, grandparents had. They're going to care that they no longer have a sustainable planet, because, you know, the capitalists before them were so greedy and destroyed everything. So, you know, we're getting into that phase now where, you know, I feel like we're in this late stage capitalism where these conversations need to be had. But then you look at our corporate media, you look at both capitalist parties, they don't want to talk about anything that has to do with socialism. I was just telling someone the other day, it's like when you watch MSNBC, they think the political Overton window stops at liberal. And they don't realize there's an entire ideology on the left, from communism to socialism, that actually is the real left. Liberalism is like a center-right capitalist ideology. Liberal does not mean left. And so I think that's one way they've controlled the conversation in America, by kind of equating this liberal ideology. The right parties in Australia are liberal. You know, there's liberal right parties in Europe. Liberal doesn't mean left, you know? And I think we have to kind of divorce this whole liberalism, which is really capitalism, from the idea of the left, which is socialism and an economy that works for everyone. And capitalism has never worked for everybody.
No. In fact, capitalism, as you are alluding to, it was never set up to work for everyone. Right. The goal of the system is to maximize profits for a few, as you were saying, at the expense of others. So, you know, when people say, oh, we need capitalism to work well, it's not working well right now, I'm like, no, this is what capitalism is. But I think your point is really important about, you know, why is it that you have the Republicans, who are the overtly pro-corporate and, you know, pro-capitalist party, and then you have the Democrats, who have a different rhetoric, but at the end of the day, the party represents the interests of the same Wall Street. I mean, why is it that you have that structure? You know, I think that it's good to also look at how a system like capitalism and the capitalist state, you know, where it has to preside, the capitalist state has to preside over massive inequalities and massive injustices, and yet not have a mood of revolt at all times. You know, so that's like, it's a question of, for the system, it's a question of managing a situation that could lend themselves to a mood of revolt, but not lead it there. So that's why I think it's something that the system has created for itself, where it needs to have one wing of its representation where it not only has different rhetoric, but what you will see, what you've seen for decades, is that the Democratic Party will give a, you know, reform, a small concession here and there, all of that, you know, just to make sure that it looks like it's working.
Right.
But at the end of the day, both parties are capitalists. But I'll just add, I mean, my home country, India, it doesn't have just two parties. It has many parties, but none of those parties represent the working class. So, you know, that's my, what I'm trying to say is that I think wherever you have a deeply unequal system like capitalism and, you know, and capitalist democracy, you know, the what I would call bourgeois democracy, you right. will see this phenomenon where you have the more overtly pro-capitalist parties and then some of the parties that are not so overtly and maybe will give in a few or one or two concessions. But at the end of the day, their role together is to maintain a certain kind of stability in an inherently unstable system. But what's changing now, and this goes back to your earlier point about what do we need to rally people into action, is that at that moment of relative stability for the capitalist class is actually gone. There right. is a lot of rumblings from below. The BLM movement and 26 million people coming out of the street and making it the largest street movement ever in US history, that didn't happen out of nowhere. That is a sign of the hunger that exists in the, you know, in the stomachs of millions of young people to do something to fight back. The legitimacy that the capitalist system had is no longer in the way that it had before. Now, that doesn't mean that a fight back and a successful fight back at that is automatic in any way. No, it's not going to happen. I mean, movements could end up in setbacks and defeats unless we had the right kind of leadership. And I think that's where most of the discussion on the left has to be on how are we going to provide a real leadership to actually win victories and empower people to fight along with us.
Yeah, and getting right back to that, that's kind of my next segment here, is I was one of the activists who helped plan and push the Force the Vote campaign to encourage progressives in Congress to take a bolder approach against Pelosi, Biden, and the establishment, and demand concessions like a Medicare for All floor vote. And while the majority of socialists and progressive activists supported our campaign, we were met with great resistance from progressives in Congress, and also from the national leadership of certain progressive organizations. And this, to me, has been the biggest disappointment about Biden's presidency so far. I didn't expect a thing out of Biden, but seeing progressives in Congress not doing anything to push back against him or the corrupt establishment has been disappointing. You know, after the election of yet another right-wing capitalist and imperialist president, progressive politicians and organizations should have moved left to challenge Biden. But instead, they're moving closer to the center, where justice and equality go to die and corporate power reigns supreme. Shama, why are progressive politicians so subordinate to the Democratic Party? And does the fact that progressives aren't even willing to fight back against Biden and the corrupt neoliberal establishment prove that the party cannot be changed from within and that it is time for an independent socialist movement and party?
I think that's absolutely correct. I mean, going back to the Force the Vote question and starting from there, I think in my view, and I wrote about this publicly, that I unfortunately don't think that the rejection of the Force the Vote tactic by the Squad, even by sections of DSA and others, that it reflected so much really a disagreement on individual tactics, which is a legitimate disagreement. You know, on the left, we need to have honest and frank discussions about policy, about
strategy.
Tactics and strategy. Yeah, and sometimes we will have disagreements. We should strive for unity and principled unity, but sometimes we may have those disagreements. But I don't think it was about a disagreement on tactics. What it was a rejection of the idea that there is a fundamental need for head-on combat with and bold challenge to the democratic establishment. It's what we see all the time, and I've seen that a lot in Seattle as well, sort of well-meaning leaders who are unwilling to actually go into a sort of a political clash with, it's not about the Democratic Party, it's about whoever is in power. That's the whole point. It's a question of, do you have the courage to take on a clash with those who are in power in the interests of those who need you to fight alongside them and for them? I think that whole debate was really interesting. It was important that we all weighed in on that debate, because it allowed us to talk about what are the most important things here. And I think It goes down to two things. One is, of course, the question of whether the party works for us or not. And as you said, I completely agree with you. The Democratic Party is not going to be transformed. I mean, I'll tell you something. That is, as I was saying, like other things, that's magical thinking, that the Democratic Party can be transformed for the left, for working people. No. Nancy Pelosi, Chuck Schumer, Joe Manchin, they are not going to allow the Democratic Party to be transformed for the working class. They will burn it to the ground first. And so I think for people—
And we saw them do that against Bernie. They did everything they could to stop him twice.
That's the most important example, actually, to show what I was saying, which is that they will sabotage their own chances of defeating the right. And in fact, now they're putting their midterm chances, they're really testing their midterm chances, depends on what they actually do. But at the end of the day, yes, they are not going to allow their party to be transformed for working people, because they represent the interests of a diametrically opposed class under capitalism. So as long as you have progressives, and I don't care how well-meaning you are, if you are trying to square that circle where politicians who represent a class with interests that are hostile to the interests of the working class, never the twain shall meet. You're not going to have that. So your task there is not to make peace and try to convince them of small little concessions here and there. No, your task is to disturb that peace there and use your position, use your podium to bring millions of people who otherwise will not have that chance. So to use your elected position as an organizing base, not as a parliamentary, let's try different tactics kind of thing. It's not about parliamentary ins and outs. It's about using a fighting strategy. So absolutely, one of the questions is about whether or not that will happen inside the Democratic Party. And I don't believe that it will. I think the left needs a new party for ourselves, new party for working people. But I think regardless of that question, I think there's another question that needs to be independently examined. And this is it's a burning question for the left, is whether it should be class struggle-based strategy or it should be a strategy of negotiations. I think that is a very crucial question, because even if you are in the Democratic Party, you could fight. You could have a fighting strategy. You could be, the squad could have called, for example, as I said, protest actions in different states in the country. They could hold their vote right now, use their numerical balance of power. But at the end of the day, it's a question of, are you willing as a leader, are you willing to make your own life deeply uncomfortable and difficult in order to do what it actually takes to represent the interests of ordinary people? And I say that is an important question, because I want to clarify to your audience that it is not only about positions of the left that we win in the legislative bodies of capitalism. This question is paramount even for elected leaders in union struggles. It is paramount for unelected leaders in social movements as well, because a very common way in which capitalism destroys movements and the potential for movements is by buying out leaders at the top.
That's
and
right.
And you can be as well-meaning as you want, and it could still happen to you. So it's not about personality. It's not about personal characteristics. Yes, personal characteristics do matter, and not everybody can play that leading role. But on the other hand, that is a smaller component. The larger component is, do we have political organizations that allow millions of rank and file people to exert that pressure on the leadership for them to do the right thing? And just to give you a concrete example, the teacher struggle in West Virginia in 2018, they won a historic victory. Why? Because the rank and file leaders in that union had the political courage and the clarity to understand that they had to openly go against the union tops at the state level, who had made a negotiation with the legislature to reject that deal and to continue their strike. If they had not done that, they would not have won what they won. But that took a lot of guts, and that took an understanding that, yes, you have to go, you have to have a full frontal opposition to the leaders who sell you out.
Absolutely. And it even activists like me, myself, the moment I left the Democratic Party, I left last year, just because of my little podcast and I have a decent sized Twitter following, when I decided not to support Joe Biden in the general, and it was the first time I didn't vote for a Democratic president, I was getting attacked from all angles from certain DNC operatives. They went so far when I was younger, when I was 18, you know, over 15 years ago, I got a DUI. They released my DUI on Twitter to try to shame me. That is the effort that the Democratic Party and the operatives go to try to shame anyone who stands up against them. But the point was, they ended up looking bad because I'm 10 years sober now. I was open about that. And I said, you know, and people are like, why are you trying to shame him for being in recovery now and for having a disease? And my point in sharing this is, it does take a lot of courage to get out there. It does take courage to fight back against the corrupt establishment. But that is the only way we're going to win victories for working people, to win the dignity and justice and respect that everyone in this country and in this world deserves. It's going to take all of us being uncomfortable in whatever way we're possible. But that little bit of courage that each of us can have, that is the spark that can ignite the kind of socialist revolution we need. It does start with each of us. You know, and since I've come out as a socialist, I mean, I've had hundreds of people say, you've inspired me, I'm going to become a socialist. I've had conservatives, lifelong conservatives say, I've never heard someone just speak plainly about socialism. I am a socialist too. I believe that the working class should control the means of production, and I'm becoming a socialist. And I'm just one little person. The more we do that, you know, the more people get bold, courage is contagious. One thing I'm really clear about is it does feel like the left seems to be caught in this abusive relationship with the Democratic Party, you know, and I can't help but think, you know, how many more times do the Democrats have to stab us in the back before the left has had enough? Do leftists want to spend the rest of our lives being bullied to vote blue no matter who in the quote unquote most important election in history? You know, the only way to end an abusive relationship is to leave it. And I finally left the party, as I said earlier, after 18 years. And it was one of the most liberating things that I've ever done. Shama, why do you think so many leftists are afraid to leave the party, despite the fact that they know exactly who the party is and that it will continue to screw over the working class? Because as long as the left holds on to this fantasy that you can move a party that is owned by Wall Street left, it deflates our efforts to build a real leftist party and movement, right? Because it's kind of, people have like one foot in, one foot out, and it detracts from building the kind of energy we need on the left to break away.
Absolutely. I think part of that, especially for a lot of genuine people who will oftentimes, and I'm sure you had that experience too, Ryan, where they'll say, I agree with you, but I don't know if I can break from the Democratic Party just yet. I think part of that is understandably that they believe that the project of starting a new political organization for working people is so daunting that it's better to stick with the Democratic Party and try to move it to the left. Now, I understand that it's a daunting task, but you know what? This whole thing of saving the planet and actually making some real shift in our society and breaking from capitalism, that whole thing is daunting. So I don't think we can decide on the basis of that. But what I think is really important is to point out what seems like is counterintuitive for people. You know, people think that it will be so hard to build a new party for working people. It is less hard and less daunting to do it through the Democratic Party. But it is actually the exact opposite, meaning it is impossible to do it inside the Democratic Party. So it's, yes, it will be hard to build a new party for working people, but it will be impossible to do it inside the Democratic Party because the Democratic Party represents, as I said before, class interests that are completely hostile to us. So it is not, as long as we stick with that kind of strategy, unfortunately, on the left, it does not activate the millions of people who could be activated if they felt there was something worth fighting for. I mean, let's be clear that it is credit to the American people that Trump was defeated. It was a repudiation of his reactionary, anti-worker, anti-immigrant, sexist, racist agenda. But the vote primarily for Biden was not for Biden. It was against Trump. It was a rejection of what they did not want. So if we want to really bring out the tens of millions of people who are willing to fight for something new, for something different, that is not going to happen as long as sections of the left are limiting themselves to what they can win in sort of in a parliamentary discussion. Most people are not paying attention to that because they don't think, correctly so, they don't think it is going to change anything for them. And in fact, the potential, if we are able to, if we can break the left away from that and really build something independent, the potential of that is so huge. I'm not going to say it's easy. It will be very hard. Yes. And as we know, the establishment and the big business will attack us every which way they can. But the point is, the potential of what could happen, the power that we could harness, is not only the tens of millions of people who identify as Democrat or vote for Democrats in general who could be activated. It's also a lot of people who supported Bernie, but then could not bring themselves to support Biden and may have voted for Trump. I mean, the threat of right populism is very real. And the best and only way of nipping the threat of right populism in the bud is to actually break people away from a reactionary agenda, which they may get end up getting attracted to because there's nothing on offer from the left. You know, ordinary people are looking for a way to fight back. And it's the obligation of the leaders on the left to provide that. And how do we provide that? It's not going to happen through the idea of, you know, let's just put all our energies back into the Democratic basket. But back to your question about why is it that, you know, what are the obstacles to breaking from this? It's also the question of elections. Like people, a lot of people on the left are hung up on winning elections. And it is important. I mean, I'm speaking as an elected representative. It is absolutely crucial that we win elected office for working people. But it is not about amassing a numerical count and then not winning any real change.
It's That's about, right. Because you know, there's a difference between winning an election for a corporate party and winning an election for actually the people and the working class. Because right now, when you're just winning an election for the blue team, when the blue team is not working for the working class, it's not really a victory for the working class and the people. It's just another victory for Wall Street and the corrupt duopoly and the decrepit capitalist system.
So yeah, we need elected representatives who will actually fight for us. But that's not something, it's not an abstract notion. To make that happen, you will need political organizations of your own. And here's where I think concretely I can tell you that whatever we have done in Seattle, I mean, we have transformed the political landscape of this city.
And your party is Socialist Alternative, for my listeners who don't know.
Yes, I'm a member of Socialist Alternative, which is a nationwide organization. We are not only based in Seattle, but we won this elected office on a socialist strategy. But people should understand that what we have been able to achieve, which is win victories that were thought of as impossible, is precisely because I have a political organization with me. It is, you know, the capitalist system, the corporate media, they want you to believe it's about personalities, it's about individuals. No, it is about collective power. Mm. And having Socialist Alternative as my organization that stands with me, that is itself rooted in the working class, that is itself accountable to the working class, that inside its own itself, in Socialist Alternative, we have a democratic sort of organization where rank and file have the ability to debate, discuss, and vote on the key decisions of the organization. That all of that has been absolutely crucial. It has been the backbone. I am not exaggerating. This has been the backbone of what I have been able to do in Seattle. So it is not about me. It's about the fact that we are, as an organization, democratically organized, and we are rooted in the working class, and we are accountable to the working class. And that is what has enabled us to not only withstand the absolute onslaught of pressure from the Democratic Party, from the establishment, and that pressure is real, but not only that, we've been able to flip the whole thing by forcing them to reckon with socialist policies. We forced them to vote on progressive policies that they had no intention of voting on, but they did that because we made it so that it was a real political price tag for them to not vote in favor of working class interests. That's what we want on a bigger scale.
Yeah, and one thing you said I think is so important is that the right, the populist right, the far right, they might have lost this last election, but they're going to bounce back stronger than ever. And the reason the right keeps bouncing back stronger than ever is because the left is weak. And the reason the left is weak is because all of the energy in the left gets sucked up by the Democratic Party, which is not a left party. It's a right-wing capitalist party. It's just not as far right as the Republican Party. So as long as we're sucking up all the left energy into this kind of, you know, this capitalist Democratic Party, that just gives more power to the right. And it allows the right to come back stronger. And until we have a strong left, a true socialist left, like you're building with Socialist Alternative in Seattle, that's the kind of politics that will absolutely end this shift that we've seen in America for the last half century to the right. If you treat people's material conditions with true socialist politics, they'll have no need for going to the right, and they definitely won't want to go to the center right where the Democratic Party is that just serves Wall Street. And so when I kind of realized that, I truly believe this, and this might be controversial to some people, but I truly believe that the biggest obstacle to progress in America is the right-wing capitalist Democratic Party and not the far-right Republican Party, because it's the Democratic Party that deceives the public into thinking they support progress when they're actively fighting against it, right? The Democratic Party is fighting against Medicare for All. It's fighting against a Green New Deal. It's fighting against the $15 minimum wage. It's fighting against real $2,000 monthly relief checks that we should have had, and now we're just getting these small $1,400 ones. You know, the Democrats, they co-opt our movements and the left and then give us tiny little breadcrumbs. They exist to just stop and stifle the left. And so when you realize that, you're like, we need a real left movement in this country, not one that's, and to get away from this party that keeps co-opting us. You recently joined the DSA, and in the article announcing your decision to join the DSA, you wrote, and I love this, I'm going to read a quote. You said, building a new mass party will not be easy, but it is absolutely necessary because the Democratic Party is under the firm grip of the capitalist class. The notion popularized by a section of the left is that socialists can take the party over. But this represents a dire underestimation of both the resistance of the establishment and the fact that the party is completely undemocratic and there are no mechanisms to take it over. A lot of the DSA members support a clean or dirty break from the Democratic Party, but the national leadership has been resistant. Are you concerned at all about their current national electoral strategy of continuing to funnel socialist movements into a capitalist party that co-opts and destroys them? And as a new DSA member, will you push for a clean break from the Democratic Party?
Oh, there's no question as to your last question. Absolutely. I mean, I'm not going to be doing anything different than what I always do. I mean, as you said, Ryan, I'm still a member of Socialist Alternative. Socialist Alternative still has our politics, and we are still an organization that believes in certain things. Anybody can check out socialistalternative.org and find out what we are about, and contact us if you're interested. But it's exactly what you were saying in terms of the part you quoted, where why am I and some of my fellow members in Socialist Alternative joining the Democratic Socialists of America is precisely to really argue for a socialist strategy, for Marxist understanding inside the DSA. And as you said, there are a lot of people inside DSA, a lot of the rank and file of DSA, who really will agree with what we are saying, but we need a real space for discussion and debate. And that is our interest. We want to generate that discussion and debate. We know there are people who disagree with us. There are lots of genuine people who may disagree with us. And to be clear, and as your own life is an example of this, not everybody comes out, you know, ready for Marxist ideas on day one. People make their own conclusions. It's a question of having patient, respectful, and ongoing debate, and at the same time being very honest about where you stand for. So we're not going to change that. And I certainly, my whole goal in joining DSA is to be able to have those discussions and debate. And I think it's also important to point out that that historic task that we have of building the socialist left, and this is one of the main reasons that we are also joining, some of us are joining Democratic Socialists, is that we believe that Socialist Alternative has a lot to contribute to this discussion. We certainly have a lot of real life experience to that we hope will educate the socialist movement and also the rank and file of the labor movement in terms of, you know, what fighting strategies can you use to succeed. But we don't have any sort of grandiose illusions that we are that new party. We want to build that new party on the left. We want to build the socialist left. And we don't expect, again, we don't have this sort of grandiose idea that everybody's going to agree with every single thing we're saying at this moment. What we want is a principled unity on the left where we can have a real stage to debate out those ideas. And those ideas should, the ideas that are the best and the most capable of representing the interests of the broader working class to really fight for ordinary people. Those ideas are the ideas that should come to the fore. And we're not claiming that we have all those ideas. I have no doubt that we have a lot to learn ourselves. But that's the point. The point is to actually have that genuine debate. And we're also not coy about showing what we have accomplished, because it is a real example. Because as you said earlier, Ryan, it's not just about having numbers of elected. It's about what do our elected representatives do. And so that's why, on that note, I should mention it is really important. I was really proud of DSA members in Chicago when they spoke out against DSA Alderman Andre Vasquez, who, as you know, voted recently for an austerity budget in Chicago. Really bad. And it's notable that he, I mean, the reason I mention this is because he was elected as a DSA member into right. Chicago, you know, city council. It's notable that he justified his vote based on the argument that he was able to negotiate improvements with the city's establishment mayor. This is one of the key debates we want to have. What is the strategy for elected representatives? And I know that there is a real audience in DSA for the kind of position that we have demonstrated in Seattle, where basing elected office on a backroom negotiation approach is not the way to go. Rather, it is to turn outward and build movements, because that is the only way we can avoid leading to more capitulations and betrayals. I mean, I don't know if you heard, there's another council member, newly elected council member in Los Angeles, Nithya Raman, who was elected in November on a platform of Black Lives Matter and opposition to police violence against the BLM protest movement. And she won, actually, it was really positive because she won a race against David Drew, a corporate Democrat endorsed by Nancy Pelosi and Hillary Clinton. And it was a grassroots campaign strongly backed by DSA. They knocked down 80,000 doors. Well, a couple of weeks ago, she joined every other LA City Council member in voting to take $9 million in funds that are supposed to be used for public housing and use those funds to put more police officers into public housing projects. She got a lot of pushback. Again, I'm really proud of DSA members for pushing back on that publicly, and it forced her to publicly apologize. You know, she said, I messed up this week. I voted yes on something I shouldn't have. I don't have any excuses. And all of that is really positive. And certainly, yeah. Unlike Vasquez, she didn't make excuses. She said, yeah, that was wrong. You're right. And I'm glad you held me to it. But I think that's what it brings up, the fundamental question of what is the role of working class elected representatives in elected bodies under capitalism. And it goes back to all the things we were talking about, Ryan, just a few minutes ago, that democratic bodies under bodies of governance under capitalism, you know, what I would call bourgeois democracy, it is set up to defend the interests of the elite. And yep. As I said before, they have managed to, you know, in the past decades, secure a relatively sort of stable setting where they make a few concessions, there are a few differences between them, but that way they prevent sharper clashes. Now, we cannot stick to that period because people are looking for something completely new. And that's why we need a real debate inside DSA about those questions. What is it that we need? And we want to, and I want to be able to win over even the people who have already been elected, maybe have made some mistakes. That's fine. You know, let's make sure that we go towards a positive direction. But one last thing I'll say, this is not just a debate about Democratic Socialists of America or inside the socialist movement. This debate needs to happen inside the labor movement. This is yes. So crucial, because we will not be able to achieve the kinds of mass movements and the scale and with the political and principled clarity that we need if we don't have rank and file leaders really fighting for a different kind of union movement, a revival of the proud American militant labor movement. And as you said earlier, you know, it was not FDR that gave us the New Deal out of the generosity of his heart. He was very clear. He was the guy between the pitchforks and the capitalists. What really won the New Deal in the 1930s and the 40s, it was the Trotskyists, the Marxists, the socialists who really helped lead massive labor struggles, historic labor struggles, and carried out general strikes in various cities, in, you know, in Minneapolis, and really were able to make the kind of shift that was needed to put serious pressure on the Democratic establishment at that time. So, you know, so the concessions that we, that the American working class was able to win at that time, they were a direct result out of militant labor movement. So I think this debate is not only important for the you know, inside the socialist circle of the left, but this debate needs to really blossom inside the labor movement as well.
Yeah, and I love that you, you know, when I first saw the article, someone sent it to me from Socialist Alternative, and they're like, don't read the headline, you know, read her actual article, because they know, you know, I think, you know, and I'm very respectful. I think we need to have disagreements. That is part of this. You know, solidarity is not built by just completely agreeing with everyone. You have to have conversations. You have to be uncomfortable. You have to understand what other people think. And when you read the article, your article announcing that you're going to stay in Socialist Alternative and join DSA, you read that like you're joining it to bring the fire and the revolutionary perspective that DSA is really lacking right now, and to bring that to the forefront of it. And one thing about politics, you know, politics is always moving. It's fluid. So like, you know, DSA got a surge in members, you know, because of Bernie's two campaigns. And Bernie was really running, you can call it democratic socialism. It's really social democracy. You know, it's not real, you know, workers own the means of production socialism, which is the Marxist perspective. But what I find interesting is, you know, the DSA is probably the biggest socialist organization right now. And I think that if, by bringing the fire and doing what you're doing and joining it because you want it to, you know, you're going to be the change you want to see, I think, you know, if the DSA broke away from the Democratic Party, I think it would be the most significant moment in the socialist movement's history in America. I would put my full support behind it. I know a lot of other socialists would as well, because I think that that's what we need. You know, we need a vehicle for all of this energy on the left that's actually going to challenge the Democratic establishment. And what I'm seeing, and what a lot of other activists I talk to see, that, you know, the squad, you know, it felt good for maybe the first 2 years, 3 years, but the moment the movement asked them for something, to, you know, force a vote on Medicare for All, hold Pelosi accountable, it was like, eh. And so the thought is like, well, I think that independence that an independent socialist movement would have, it's a lot easier to challenge the Democratic Party when you're outside of it than when you're inside of it, trying to kind of play parliamentary games and you know, not wanting to disturb Pelosi or get on her bad side. And like you've said, that kind of insider parliamentary tactic is not how we're going to win victories for working people. That's going to happen by building the movements, by bringing mass movements of people fighting for socialist policies. And so I just applaud you for the courage and the willingness to go into a new organization and to bring your Marxist perspective, because in my view, that's exactly what DSA needs. And I think if DSA did that, I think it would be the vehicle for the left to actually build power for the working class.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. And you know, I think it's important to note, as you noted, in DSA is the largest socialist organization, and it's now the second largest socialist organization in U.S. history. And it is the current expression of what people call Big Tent socialism. In other words, you know, it's an organization with different trends. And obviously, there are lots of trends that I wouldn't agree, whose ideas I wouldn't agree with. But there are a lot of people who will agree with what we're saying. And so some political trends identify as Marxist. They have different interpretations. Some do not. Socialist Alternative is explicitly a revolutionary internationalist Marxist organization that is part of International Socialist Alternative, which is an organization that has sister organizations in 30 countries around the world. And we are not a federation of organizations. We actually work together because we feel that that is the kind of cohesion the international working class is going to need in order to fight this global system of capitalism, because they're certainly, you know, interlinked. And even though there are competitive interests among the different sections of the capitalist class, at the end of the day, they band together to uphold a deeply unjust system. And so we have to really have a strategy of fighting back. And the reason we have socialist alternative, but also some of us are joining DSA at the same time, is because we believe that the socialist movement needs both of these kinds of organizations at this moment. And it's exactly what you were saying. I mean, the question of moving to building a new party, I don't expect that everybody in DSA is going to agree with, but I do expect that many will. But how can we get to that point unless we really have a discussion about it?
Right.
So that's one strategic question. The other question also is about what does it mean even to be a socialist? I mean, and I'll tell you why I'm saying that, because to give you a concrete example, you know, there are important debates taking place right now in Seattle DSA, nationally as well. But to give you one concrete example, there was a discussion recently in Seattle DSA about their political platform. And this was before I joined. And some leaders of one of the caucuses in the organization argued against the inclusion of a call for a democratic public ownership of the big energy corporation. This was their whole platform on the Green New Deal. And I was not present for the debate, but it was very disappointing for me to hear of the vote to not include this fundamental point about socialism. And in fact, there are lots of people who don't call themselves socialists, but who are tuned into the climate change debate and who agree completely that it is a non-starter
yep.
for any shift away from climate change unless we take the top energy corporations into democratic public ownership. So that's the kind of debate where we need Marxists to be there to boldly fight. Even if you don't get agreement at this moment, you have to have the courage to fight for those ideas and not capitulate to what I think are really wrong ideas. And
because if you're not there, then it's just going to keep, that's how, you know, things get co-opted and move more to the center, because yes. they don't have the revolutionary forces pulling them to the left toward justice.
Yeah. And that's the thing. And that's the historic duty of revolutionaries, of Marxists, of socialists. It's not about having great ideas. It doesn't matter how great your idea is if you don't have the courage to fight for that idea and right. build support around it. So that's our main job. It's not just, you know, being great intellectuals. It's not about navel gazing. It's about understanding what the correct ideas are and then going out and fighting for them. That's what distinguishes socialist alternative from other forces, is that we have a certain set of ideas. We believe in them. We are not shy of them. And we will argue for them. And we will take part in any kind of debate that is needed in order to reach the broader audiences of the working class. And we will win working class people over on the basis of our ideas, not on the basis of personalities or anything like that.
And sorry, I just looked at the clock. I could talk to you all day, Kashama. Sorry I've kept you for so long. I really appreciate it, though. This has been such an insightful conversation. I wanted to ask you, kind of as we're wrapping up here, and it might be an annoying question, so if you think it's annoying, you can... don't feel like you have to answer, but do you have any plans to run for a higher office when you're done in Seattle? And do you think that benefits the socialist movement to have visionary leaders like yourself in higher offices, whether it's Congress or the Senate, or, you know, do you think that helps the movement to have, you know, people like you that have the visionary, bold leadership in those positions?
Do I think it would benefit the movement? Hell yes.
Yeah.
And I'm not annoyed by that question, because I don't take it as a personal question. I don't, you know, because I'm not here to build my own personal career or to build some sort of cult of personality around myself. This is about actually building the socialist movement in the interests of the working class to actually go towards socialism. And so from that point of view, it absolutely will benefit our movement, and it will benefit working people to have elected representatives who will bring the similar kind of fighting strategy that we have brought in Seattle. But I think that question is closely tied not only about what we will do in Socialist Alternative, but it is also tied to the question of building a larger political organization. Because, you know, no doubt that it will benefit if Socialist Alternative ran a candidate and was able to win a more high profile office. But I don't think the question can stop there, because that's not enough.
You know,
as I said, we need bigger political organizations to be doing that, but then it has to be on the right basis as well. And that's where we can absolutely play a role. And just to give a glimpse of what could be achieved with such a seat at a national level, let me just put it concretely. Today, if we had a fighting Marxist, a socialist in Congress who had similar strategies that we are building through Socialist Alternative, imagine what they could have done. If they had called on marches and rallies for $15 an hour and put the kind of...
Force the vote on Medicare for All.
Yes, absolutely. But but not just force the vote in a parliamentary way, but calling for force the vote, refusing to support Nancy Pelosi, but all of that by building strengths on the outside, by building mass movements, by building organizations. Like you know, how we built the 15 Now movement. We won the Amazon tax, for example, by building the Tax Amazon movement, which held action conferences with hundreds of people participating in each of those action conferences. Imagine what's possible if we did that at a national level. That's why the question of a new party for the working class is so concretely and urgently posed, because that is what we will need, because no one individual will be able to accomplish this. The pressure to give up and conform with the establishment is so sharp that we will need political organizations, not just individuals, to fight back against it.
And you know, there are a lot of Marxists who I'm learning a lot from, and you know, that will say things like, well, electoral politics doesn't matter, and we need a vanguard party, and which is all true, but at the same time, to build that vanguard party and to build the kind of organization we need, it does help to have, like you're saying, a Marxist in Congress, because that's going to teach and educate and enlighten more people on what real workers own the means of production socialism is, and it will get them to help us build the kind of movement we need by having that kind of visionary leader with a national platform in Congress, right? It kind of feeds the whole engine to kind of get us to this kind of revolutionary party and movement that we need to replace capitalism with socialism. And so it seems like electoral politics is a tool, if you will, that putting someone like a Marxist in Congress can only help us get to where we want to go.
Yes, I completely agree with you. I would just say, there's a misunderstanding on the left, and also just in discussions on the left, that electoral politics, when they say electoral politics, they mean anything related to the left having an elected office. I have a different interpretation of it. Electoral politics to me means relying on the idea that you elect people, so you only have whatever so-called movement for elections. And then after that, we leave it to the electeds to do whatever they're doing in a parliamentary fashion. To me, that's electoral politics. Winning elected positions that are going to be used as part of building a fighting movement, I don't see that as electoral. And I'll go back to a point that I made earlier, which is that even if the left, it would be incorrect if the left did that, but even if the left shunned any kind of fighting back on to win elected positions in the legislative bodies, the questions about what the movement's leaders need to do, they are still posed. How will unionizing battles succeed? How will the labor movement build the kind of historic, just earth-shattering movements that we need at this moment? How are we going to win democratic ownership of energy companies, for example, with movements on the street? We saw just now, we had the biggest street movement in US history in the form of Black Lives Matter. But right now, many of the rank and file activists who are part of the movement are questioning, what did we win out of this?
Right.
And where did it fall short? It brings again and again and again, no matter which sphere of a social change you're looking at, it brings up real questions of what does it actually mean for leaders to be accountable. It is not a formalistic concept. Accountability is not a formalistic concept. Accountability is not about, oh, do I have meetings? Do you have the quote-unquote seat at the table? That's nonsense. That is all fake. Real accountability is, are you willing to use your position to fight like hell for ordinary people at every moment of the day in a way that will make your own life very hard? I mean, people who are watching this might think that it is some sort of self-praise or some sort of exaggeration or, hyperbole. It's not. I promise you, it is not about me. It is not hyperbole. It is very real. Because once you are in any kind of leadership position, the system will try to co-opt you or they will try to marginalize you.
Yep.
How do you avoid both those pitfalls? It's a minefield. So how do you do that? It's by shoring yourself up with with millions who are willing to fight alongside you. And this question will come up again and again and again in social movements and in revolutionary movements as a whole. And unfortunately, if history is any guide, we will also see betrayals, we will see setbacks, all of that will happen. But the question is, how do we, those of us who really want to fight, how do we make sure that we don't have those kinds of setbacks? It will require leaders. And I don't mean some special chosen ones. It will require hundreds, thousands, tens of thousands of leaders at every level to shun those attempts by the ruling class to buy them out and to really fight for ordinary people. And yes, it only happens in a way that makes your own life hard. There is no universe where I can do what I'm doing and my personal life is easy in the sense that the Democrats don't hate me. There is no universe where I can call them out and then they like that. No, they don't like that. But I don't, and this is very crucial, Ryan, I don't go to City Hall seeking approval and friendship and respect from them. No, in reality, they treat me pretty badly, some of them. But you cannot allow that to crush you because, and the first lesson number one of being a genuinely accountable leader is, you have to tell yourself 100 times a day, it's not about you. It's not. So when they give you praise, when the establishment gives you praise as a carrot policy or then a stick policy where they insult you, neither of that is about you. The praise is not for you. The insults are not directed at you. Both are attempts to divide you from whom you're actually fighting alongside. And so you avoid both and you go to the working class for approval. So if the working class said I was selling them out, that would worry me. It doesn't worry me that the Democrats hate me. I mean, yeah, that comes with the territory. And I'll tell you something. If they like you, you're doing something wrong.
That's right. You're absolutely right. And if we continue to play patty cakes with the corrupt neoliberal establishment, there'll be no change for working people or for this planet. And, you know, I just want to thank you. I think you're one of the most visionary leaders in the socialist movement right now. I want to thank you for fighting like hell for the working class, for putting yourself out there. How can my listeners support you? I know there's a solidarity campaign right now to defend your seat from the big business and the right that are trying to take it away from you. Where can they go to, chip in $5-$10 if they can to your solidarity campaign to make sure we keep that seat for you, in Seattle?
Thank you so much, Ryan. I just want to say likewise, this conversation was absolutely delightful. Thank you so much for yourself for standing up to I see a lot of the attacks that you come under on Twitter. And it is so, that's a good example. You're not an elected official, but you come under those attacks because you're standing up for the right things. I think that's what we have to be prepared for. And the recall attack against us is in the similar vein. And I think the left nationally has an interest in defeating this recall. So please go to shamasolidarity.org. That's my first name, KSHAMA, solidarity, one word, .org to find more information. We absolutely need urgent donations. We know the recall campaign is amassing all kinds of money, all kinds of billion. It's a billionaire who's who that's supporting the recall. And the only way we fight back is through grassroots donations. But it's not only that. The left as a whole needs to amplify this question about the recall. We need discussions in every city from the left about why it's important to defeat the recall. So if you're watching this and you want to host a discussion in your own city among people on the left that you know about, who will be eager to hear about this, contact our campaign's website. We will make sure that discussion happens. We will have someone there. I will be there if I can be. We need to make sure we defeat this recall.
Shama, thank you so much for everything. Thank you for this last hour and a half and solidarity and look forward to continuing the fight with you to liberate the planet and the people from capitalist rule.
Well said. Thank you so much and solidarity to you as well, Ryan.
Thanks for listening to today's episode of Amped Up with Ryan Knight. And before I go, I want to take this moment to thank our benefactors who make this show possible, who contribute at least $20 a month to the program. I want to thank Tyler Sambucci, Nat Tacito, Ed Romo, John Littman,
Tiffany Mahmood, John Paul DeLuca, Susan Sarandon, DJ Comatose, Patty Cleary, Elizabeth Kim, and Lloyd Chapman. Thank you so much for your generous donations. And thank you, everyone, for supporting the podcast and supporting my work. I really appreciate it. Again, go to patreon.com/ampedup if you want to support the podcast as well. And for as little as $5 a month, you'll get access to our bonus content. Have a great weekend, everyone, and we'll catch you next week with an all-new episode of Amped Up with Ryan Knight.